Peter Goodburn, founding partner of WaveTrack International. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Great, Tom. Thanks for having me again. I'm really pleased to see you.
So, Peter, we're speaking this morning on March 3rd, Tuesday, March 3rd. Of course, for me, it's the morning in the West here. It's the morning for you. It's the afternoon already. But I wanted to start by asking you, obviously, over the weekend, we had the developments with the new conflict in Iran starting with Israel, the US, all of these different players involved. The markets didn't seem to have too much of a reaction yesterday on Monday, the 2nd. So far in the first couple hours of the markets on the 3rd here, they are really starting to take a decisive turn on a lot of different commodities, metals, currencies, things like that. So why don't we start by talking a little bit about if big events like this and the volatility associated with them ever invalidate a technical and especially, let's say, Elliott wave-based view on the markets or analysis of the markets?
Yeah, I guess the clear answer is that in its purest form, Elliott wave is supposed to discount the sort of fundamental news. Actually, fundamentals are supposed to follow the price action. The other way around to the conventional idea that, you know, fundamentals dictate price action. It's not the case from an Elliott perspective. We often see trends developing, you know, far in advance of exogenous events like we've just seen, you know, break out in the Middle East. So, and that's certainly been the case, actually, with precious metals, you know, because since the US started to attack Iran over the weekend, actually precious metals have actually traded down, which is a good example of things, because, you know, the natural reaction would have been, okay, let's buy gold and silver because they're safe havens. Prices should accelerate up and break new highs. But they haven't. They've actually remained below where we were in late January. And actually, we've been seeing the last 2 days some very steep declines in gold and silver. So how do you account for that? Well, you know, we already saw a good example of expectation that gold and silver would be turning down around this point in time. Some of the upside targets for rallies that we had at the back end of January, early February, when gold and silver started to rally, we had met those upside targets precisely into last Monday. And then they've been turning down through the rest of the session yesterday and now today. So basically, if you've done the analysis correct, it should be a point where you have a bit of an insight to the price action. Now, sometimes what invariably happens is that you make a price forecast on something using the Elliott wave approach. And depending on the percentage move of that forecast, I mean, let's assume that it's something more than just a few percent. You know, it's a 20-30% move that you're actually forecasting. And you might then say, well, on such a move, I would have an educational guess that that will be because of an outbreak of war, or it might be because in the case of oil prices going up this week, or it might be something more mundane, like the Federal Reserve. What policy are they doing? And from my experience, applying the Elliott wave method for more than several decades now, often we try and give an educational guess on what the outcomes might be to the price action that we're forecasting, and invariably it might be different, completely different. And sometimes, yeah, we might be spot on. But here we've got a particular situation where, you know, it's a complete exogenous event. And yet we're still able to predict gold prices and silver prices going down when the natural idea is that their safe havens should be going up. So, you know, this is really quite humbling when you look at a price forecast and an expectation of gold going down, and it has. Mm-hmm. So in a way, Elliott wave discounts a lot of the exogenous shocks. Sometimes, you know, we don't quite analyze correctly, and you get some sort of extreme. And if there is an extreme, it's usually short-lived, and then it reverts back to to a normal standard deviation. I think one of the things which I was looking at this morning, which went a little bit awry from our forecast, was European TTF Dutch gas, natural gas. You know, that's shot up 100%. We're used to seeing big percentages in those, by the way. It's already been down over 100% over the last several months. But it's shot up again. Whereas if you look at US natural gas prices, they're up maybe 5%. That's it. Not, they haven't really budged much at all. There's plenty of supply of natural gas. But Europe is between, you know, if European prices have been particularly impacted because of, you know, they're getting a lot of their gas from Qatar, which has obviously been hit. So, yeah, sometimes you get these exogenous events that can actually move prices outside of the standard deviation for a couple of standard deviations, but then it will revert back fairly quickly again, which I expect for European natural gas. But that's about the only one, I think, that really has gone outside of our sphere of different markets.
Peter, I think a good way to also frame today's discussion, obviously we're going to talk about many metals, many commodities, but to really, I guess, address the underpinning of how you're analyzing these markets and how you understand a path forward is through the shock, pop, drop cycle. So how is inflation following that path? And therefore, let's say every commodity and price input into that plays into inflation.
Yeah, I mean, this is quite a fascinating story, actually, you're picking up on, because we've been talking about revisiting the shock, pop, drop scenario just recently in our annual 2026 commodities report, which we published at the end of January. And this is a couple of slides from that report. The shock, pop, drop scenario I first adopted back in 2010 after the financial crisis sell-off, because I recognized at the time there was a bit of a dislocation between what stock index prices were doing at that time over the longer term and what commodity prices were doing. What we found was, through an investigation going back to the Great Depression lows of 1932, we found that stock markets during the financial crisis, when prices dropped down on the S&P to its low at 666, we found that was ending a fourth wave correction in the greater scheme of things, in a five wave uptrend that really dated back to the Great Depression, and that a fifth wave would be a normalized uptrend, a secular bull uptrend, which most people refer to, from that base low in March 2009. But when we took a look at commodity prices from the Great Depression lows, things like crude oil and copper prices in particular, we found that there was already a typical Elliott uptrend of five waves, finishing from that Great Depression lows into the peaks in 2007, the pre-financial crisis peaks. And that when both prices of commodities and stock markets collapsed during the financial crisis, they bottomed in October 08, March 09. We recognized that when the recovery occurred afterwards, stock markets continued their secular bull uptrend into what deems to be, in Elliott terms, a five-wave uptrend. But commodity prices weren't taking that same format. They were moving up into a three-wave scenario and were destined to make new record highs at some stage into the future. And this is what we called the pop phase. The financial crisis was really the shock, because mainstream didn't expect that collapse. But the pop phase, we recognized, was basically going to be a commodity inflation period of asset price inflation running up. And the reason behind that was because we could see that quantitative easing was coming to an end by central banks, And eventually that would release to a period of asset price inflation and eventually real inflation pressures. And it would, and real inflation in this format would be very atypical of three price swings up for commodity prices. And that's exactly how it's been playing out since. We haven't really got to what I refer to as the B wave top, the inflation pop peak, which is where I'm pointing to up here. I mean, that's still coming in towards the end of the current decade.
Yeah, 2028, 2030, for those that are just listening on audio.
Okay. And so these three phases, the shock, pop, drop, you know, the shock was the initial financial crisis sell-off. But the pop phase, the inflation pop, really is the B wave, which takes us into new record highs. That has to happen because stock markets are working still through their secular bull uptrends. But for commodity prices, in Elliott wave terms, the B wave is often accompanied by erratic news flows, things like inflation re-emerging after quantitative easing suppressed inflation pressures. And so we recognize that this was an asset price inflation pop, and it would take decades to unravel. And this is where we are at the moment. We're probably about two thirds of the way in to that inflation pop. You know, we've still got another third to go into the final sort of 4 or 5 year period into the end of the decade. But once that's finished, we're going to get the drop phase, which is the deflationary drop. That's going to be really harmful because that's when asset prices will collapse. You know, and you might find that, you know, asset prices could collapse somewhere between sort of 70, 80, 90%, depending on which asset class you're looking at. So that's going to be really devastating. So anybody tuning in that wants to protect themselves in the future, you know, you've really got to take that protection and start to look at other ways in which to protect your wealth and well-being before that financial collapse occurs. But we've still got some years to go yet where that, and there will be various twists and turns in that last phase, but you know, we're still in that inflation pop sequence, and that's obviously going to affect interest rates still. You know, we've had a very big surge in interest rates from the pandemic lows into the October 23 highs in things like 10-year treasury yields, into tips, 10-year tips yields. And we're undergoing a bit of a correction down at the moment, which I think will last until the end of next year. And then from about the end of 2027 onwards, looking at that time cycle, I expect then 3 or 4 years into the end of the decade, where we make new record, well, we make significant double-digit percentage highs in interest rates. So we could be looking at things like 10% in Fed funds, things like that. You know, that's very probable, I think. Almost inevitable, really. But, you know, you will see in between that time still quite a bit of asset price inflation. You know, recently we've been talking about, you know, where commodities go in during that phase and what the dollar's going to be doing. You know, I mean, the dollar on our long-term charts suggests that the dollar's, I think this time last year we were talking about King Dollar finishing its luster, and the King Dollar will, you know, eventually the crown will fall, and the dollar will start to resume its medium-term downtrend, which, you know, or long-term downtrend, which began from 1985's peak when the dollar index was above 160. And sure enough, that happened. You know, we've seen since then a 10-12% decline in the dollar, but that's only the first phase of things. This year, we're talking about a 6% upswing for the dollar index before it goes down again later. But generally, the medium to long-term outlook for the dollar is very bearish. So, you know, that's going to traditionally, if you've got a weaker dollar, that's going to help the inflation pop assets, because most assets in commodities are priced in dollars these days. So, you know, that eventually down the road will mean that you've got, you know, much higher prices for commodities still coming through the pipe. But it's important to get each single commodity in the right perspective, which is part of this report that we're looking and delving into at the moment, because Some of the aspects that we're looking at, things like copper, has been artificially is artificially high copper prices at the moment. They've been part of a roadshow of investment banks and media manipulation, where copper prices have gone up. The rest of the base metals that we tend to look at in a group, things like aluminium, lead, zinc, nickel, tin, these markets haven't really gone up very much. For that reason, I think copper has been extended through a certain amount of media manipulation because of the demand in things like data centers. Data centers are only using about 2% of global copper production at the moment. 2%, that's all. It's not having a big impact on the overall consumption layer. It's not at all. And in fact, inventories are rising for copper quite a bit. I can show you this particular graphic, which...
Peter, sorry, just before we move on here, if you could go back to that last slide, I just wanted to ask, obviously since the 2007 or 2007 shock and then the subsequent run in asset prices, how does another, let's say, inflationary impulse from a, let's say, a monetary standpoint, like the pandemic response, does that also kind of feed into that pop scenario and help propel us to that 2028, 2030 target? Or does it create a similar time cycle that propels asset prices after that, after this next or this coming peak?
No, well, I think the overall scenario is that when we see from the post-pandemic interest rates rising, that's really giving us the second phase of the inflation pop. The first phase is just purely asset prices rising, but now we're getting real interest rates rising and we're getting inflation rising. So the deflation era is over, and this inflation pop scenario is now fully operational, because it's not only just asset prices with a declining dollar over the longer term, it's also showing real interest rate rises and of course inflation rises. Now CPI topped out in its interim phase in about August 22-23. We had interest rates in the US about 9%, I think. In Europe, it was almost 10 CPI, and then they've dropped down quite a bit, as to about 2.5% in the States now, and 2.7%. In Europe, it's 1.7%. But this will flatline for probably another 12 months. I think the CPI will flatline. I don't think you'll get any significant appreciation in CPI, any significant uptick anytime soon. I don't think so. I don't think you'll get that until oil prices have bottomed, but they're still correcting down from the March 22 highs at the moment. And even though oil prices are running up at the moment and gas prices in Europe are running up at the moment, these are corrections. They won't last indefinitely. And even if President Trump says, well, our campaign in the Middle East might run 4 or 5 weeks, there's a dislocation always with how the fundamental news. You can't just say, well, oil prices will exponentially rise for 4 or 5 weeks. if you're a realist in trading and doing analysis, that's just not the case. You can't assign one to the other. And for that reason, I think crude oil prices will have a certain ceiling at the moment. Even before this latest incursion into the Middle East has occurred, we had upside targets from December's lows in crude oil up to about $80, 70 or 80. So, and this was before any of the situation started to spark in the Middle East. So that's natural recurrence, and we haven't seen any deviation from that plan so far. But ultimately, when we talk about the inflation pop over that period of time and the combination, as you were saying, about pandemic lows and then triggering inflation and interest rates. You know, this is part of the process that we're going to see. So it's going to be, you know, a combination of things into the end of the decade. It's going to be asset prices increasing. It's going to be interest rates rising at some later date again, not just now. They're in a transitory pause phase, but they will have another resurgence up at some point. And, you know, you'll also see, you know, CPI inflation kicking on again, having another reattempt at those 22 highs. You know, it'll be a combination of those things, really.
So then, Peter, to get back to what you were saying and kind of where we're going with this particular idea is, how does that ratio of copper to crude interact, and what is that telling us?
Well, I wanted to, in this particular report, I wanted to have a look at the very long-term situation on copper versus crude, because there's a very big dislocation going on. I mean, copper prices, of course, have been just recently record highs. And yet, crude oil is down 50% from the March 22 high. So that seems a bit odd, because in an inflation pop scenario, we should be seeing congruent sort of rallies and advances at the same time. And yet crude oil has been dampened down a bit. Mm-hmm. When we see this type of dislocation, they should normally fall back into sync, into price sync. In Elliott wave terms, when we look through the lens of Elliott wave to understand these things, pattern sync is not always the same as price sync. Mm-hmm. Price sync, I'm talking about prices simultaneously going up and down. That doesn't mean to say that the amplitudes are the same either. They can change, which causes spread relationships to change. But it also can, because those performance relationships change, which causes spread relationships changing, that also causes pattern changes. And what we're talking about is also pattern desynchronization at the moment, where you've got basically oil prices from the March 22 highs still in a correction downwards, but you've got copper that's been making new highs. They've got to be recalibrated. So I wanted to have a quick look at that. And just to let you know, it started off with this chart, which actually is now 15 years old. This was actually made in October 14. It was made in 2010. And at that point, we started talking about the inflation pop in copper prices moving up from the financial crisis sell-off. And this is LME, London Metal Exchange, 3 months, dollars per ton, 28.15. And we said that the inflation pop will encompass a three price swing event into new record highs, get to about 13.925. I don't know whether you can see that top right here, but we're talking about a big, big swing into new record highs at 13.925. And if I move to the next chart, you'll see that there was an interim phase of declines, and then we had this 13.925 or 13.920 area coming in into the future. And eventually we got there just recently. We've actually got to that precise number. And that's really quite amazing to make a forecast like that, particularly given that it wasn't just a price forecast. We actually signified that the pattern sequence would unfold from this secondary low in 2016 as five price swings up, which is exactly what's happened. And yet, of course, oil prices are still very low. So we started to look at the relationship between copper and crude oil and put this ratio together. So it's copper divided by oil, crude oil. And it goes back to the 1980 period low here. We have got data going back to the turn of last century, but this is the important bit from 1980 onwards. The dollar, of course, topped out in 1985. This ratio bottomed in 1980, 1981, around the same time the interest rates topped out. And we've recognized that the entire ratio is unfolding into a very typical, what we call a zigzag pattern. You have an initial ratio that widens out from a period of 44 to 244. So this was in the 1980s. And then you had a decennial sort of decline as a correction down into the 2002-3 low here at 46.63. And then you've got to go through a repetition of five price swings up again. Similar magnitude, maybe a little bit more. And this five-wave event is taking the form of, in Elliott wave terms, what we call a diagonal. It naturally consumes a lot more time than the preceding comparable five-wave pattern in wave A from the 1980-85 period. And this one, it measures a target that we have up to about 364. We thought, wow, that means that copper's still outperforming crude oil for the next 12 months or more. And when we did a bit of reverse engineering on the sort of the pattern sequences of crude oil and what copper was doing, we came to two very important conclusions. The first one was that copper would, first of all, have to revert back to a more normalized standard deviation. It would have to collapse, which is this movement down from 233 to 138. That means that this year, copper is very vulnerable to a collapse down in prices. And after that, the ratio should widen out to about 364. But when we did the reverse engineering, that meant that actually, basis where we think copper's going to be during the collapse, oil prices will probably end up trading a lot lower than we originally thought. We thought that the March 22 decline on oil prices would bottom around $48. But we think that it's probably going to now bottom around $34 basis this ratio. And this is a very specific pattern, so we've assigned it a very high probability outcome. So these two things will recalibrate eventually, both in price sync and pattern. If copper collapses lower and oil trades down to $34 like this within the next 12 months, then they can both recalibrate again, because at the moment they're out of whack. Copper's too high relative to where crude oil is. So this was a very illuminating ratio for us, because it gave us a bit of a clue how they can recalibrate back in both pattern and in price sync, ready for the final splurge up in the inflation pop. And of course, if we did get down to $34 much later this year, early next, once we've attuned into that climb completing from the March 22 high here at 130.50 on crude oil, if we can get down to 34 bucks on crude oil at that point, then it will release the final phase of the inflation pop. And then we go up from $34 to something like minimum 194, but probably 232. I mean, that's a phenomenal increase. But you're probably then looking at situations like, an accelerating decline in the dollar and, high interest rates. And I know the two might not seem logical, but if you've got, as we've seen this week, Treasury yields suddenly this week have popped back up. Why would they? Why wouldn't bond buyers be pulling yields lower? Well, because there's a certain mistrust in not only the dollar being a reserve currency nowadays, so we've got de-dollarization going on, but you've got a bit of a mistrust about the financial well-being of the United States built around its Ponzi scheme of financing credit. Mm-hmm. So you might get dollar going down and interest rates going up accordingly. That's something that's been very topical in the last 12, 18 months, mm-hmm. that discussion. So I think that's probably going to be the landscape of what we've got, but it means that copper's got to collapse this year as well to make this work. Otherwise it doesn't work. So mm-hmm. that's really, it's quite significant, because with copper prices being the subject of data centers and things like that, and also the fact that it's, one of the most topical issues of being bullish for investment banks, we tend to disagree with that completely. I think that copper prices are very vulnerable to the downside risk at the moment.
Peter, how does that, what does that ratio end up saying for how high we could see oil go over the next 2 years here?
Well, I think the ratio, just going back to that here, if we're going to get this pattern finishing up at this ratio area around 350, 360-ish, that sort of area, then oil prices have to go down first to $34 because after this pattern finishes, this is a pattern that started in 1980, in the early 1980s, and is finishing. And if oil prices, underlying oil prices, can be, we can attune to that with a very high probability outcome, but let's call it $200 a barrel, then there's no way that oil prices will go to $200 whilst copper is outperforming with this ratio going to 350, 360. That doesn't really work. If you calculate the numbers and do the reverse engineering, it's not going to work out because that would mean copper is going to go so high that it falls outside of even the inflation pop cycle that we've got going back to the Great Depression lows. It just doesn't work. The calculation doesn't work. So you can eliminate that as a probability. So if this pattern is going to finish around 350, 60, the ratio, and then it's going to contract, well, that contraction would fit the profile of oil going from $34 to 200. That's exactly when it does fit the rip. And it won't contract, that ratio won't contract that much unless oil prices are suddenly outperforming copper. So that does fit with the scenario. But that means that in the immediate path for the next 12 months or so, we've got to expect oil prices at some stage to trade down to $34, which is an interesting hypothesis, especially now that we know that the Middle East is all kicking off, and in the short term, oil prices are going up. But that's why I believe that although we've got short-term prices going up at the moment, there's going to be a certain limit by how much they can actually advance. That puts a cap on the oil prices in the immediate future, because even with what's kicking off in the Middle East, because it means that basically we've got to get down to $34 before we start to get real interest up to 200. I mean, a lot of pundits were at the weekend putting social media on the fact that they were speculating that oil would open up on Monday morning at $100 a barrel, which wasn't the case at all. We got up to 76, then pulled back to 72 yesterday. It's nothing like that. And I think the mitigation might come through because, we had in December when oil prices were 58 and a half, 59, we were talking about 78, 80, which was a very contrarian thing to do at the time. Now it's not contrarian, it's mainstream. 80 is even thought of as too low because we've been trading pretty much close to that today. But there's a lot of overhead resistance in this price rally, and I do believe that we will have to trade down to $34, maybe much later this year at some point, so that the recalibration of copper and oil realigns itself, because they're definitely out of whack, these two commodities at the moment, and they're two very important commodities, of course. The only other important ones are the precious metals, gold and silver, but these are otherwise are the two most important commodities on the planet. So it's important to get a grip of an understanding of how they're interacting.
So, Peter, you mentioned the idea that there were certain people that expected oil to go to $100 right away. People also would have expected gold and silver, let's say especially gold, the kind of safe haven here, to have reacted positively, a flight to safety. And yet we've seen gold go down, I think, over $100 at this point today already. Why do you think, from the not only the technical perspective, but why is it reacting that way? Because a lot of people, that confuses a lot of people to the, let's say, the way that they think it should happen.
Well, I mean, we don't have daily statistics to show us exactly who's selling gold and silver at the moment. But when we've had severe events in the past, even the financial crisis going back to 2007-8, when the stock markets were collapsing, actually gold and silver collapsed lower as well. And also during the pandemic, if you remember, I mean, silver basically halved in a very, very short space of time, went down to about 11.75, $12. And this was because in times of of extreme uncertainty, rather than the precious metals being a safe haven, people tend to liquidate long positioning in especially in an overbought condition market, because it helps pay margin calls in other areas. And also the fact is that, you know, it's a convertible to money. So, you know, if you want money for food because you're in a lockdown, or and you need to realize cash, it's a convertible to cash, you know, in really extreme certain situations. I can only think that that's what's happening here from a fundamental point of view. And we know that, you know, gold in particular as a global commodity is not just traded in the Western sphere, you know, it's traded in the Middle East and in Asia, and it really is considered a convertible to money. So in those times of extremes, you know, you often find that when there is financial extreme and stress, that you can actually see a temporary period of gold and silver moving downwards. You know, it's not always an inversion to be a safe haven. But, you know, from a technical point of view, we actually predicted in our in this annual report that gold and silver were approaching a major peak. And this was obviously before the actual highs were registered in the end of January. And then when we started to see the sell-off in gold and silver, we started to update in our bi-weekly reports. And in those bi-weekly reports, this is an extract from February the 5th. So this was almost a month ago, showing the initial decline in gold trading down in a five price swing sequence to 4403. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with Elliott Wave, you know, the direction of price movement is often defined by five waves, and the counter trend of that sequence is measured in threes. And at the time, we recognized that there was five price swings down to 4403, which meant downside continuity, at least one more sell-off would to come once the upswing correction is finished. Now, the upswing correction, we had two phases. We had the first one to 4650, pulling back a little bit, and then going up to 5380. And I think if I just click on something we produced last night for gold, just pull that across, see what it looks like. You'll see. Keep in mind this downswing to 4650, and then a final swing up to 5380, and you can see that's pretty much what happened. We had to pull back down to 4655. An attempt at 5380, which nudged slightly through on Monday morning at 5418. And here we are trading today down at 5,000. We've already dropped, you know, $400. We're basically down here today. I mean, that's pretty amazing to actually forecast something up to that within 20, 30 bucks and then getting a complete reversal. And what that means is, of course, that means that gold is now going to have a big shakeout down to 4,000. So on that basis, if we were to extrapolate the theme of the idea that money is needed at the moment, and the reason for gold sell-off might be just the fact that margin calls are coming in for other asset classes, other things are under stress, then, of course, that would seem to suggest that we're going to get more liquidation, you know, more of the same, at least in gold. I think this is just a transition point, because if we are fortunate enough to get gold down to 4,000, above that sort of area, you know, that represents a really great opportunity to go long again. But I think it's necessary to see a break below 4403 at least, which is, of course, this late January low. From the initial sell-off, we need to get below there. But that's, you know, we're currently at 5112 at the right now. We've been to 5,000 today, but that means that we've still got downside risk of something like $1,000. which is huge. But, you know, this has ticked all the boxes so far, these forecasts, since early February.
Do you think that the central bank buying has kind of abated, and that is that also has to play in that low side target as well?
Well, I had a look at some of the central bank data coming out from Gold Council, and if you put it on a quarterly reverting basis, average basis, the peak in central bank buying was actually in 2022, funny enough, when CPI topped out. And for the last year and a half, it's actually been gradually working its way, trickling downwards. So the amount of central bank buying hasn't been quite the same to keep the average going up and up and up all the time. So it has been on the wane anyway. And I mean, central bank buying is still going on, but it's just not at the same pace as before. What's really, I've noticed really is that, you know, I'm a bit of a night owl when I'm trading. And I've noticed that most of the gold and silver activity is happening during the nighttime when we should be asleep. And that's because Asia is now taking over as the big hub for trading. So whereas bullion, gold and silver volume has normally been associated with trading out of London, that's where most of the volume, the OTC trading, has been going on and has been going on for decades. We're now seeing an integral change of that, because a lot of the activity, you know, some of the big movements I found that were occurring in my European time at 2 a.m., 2:30, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, when we should be asleep. And that's happening because there's huge amounts of speculation. Last time I was in Hong Kong, I met a group of women, actually, in a private club. And you wouldn't believe it, they're all trading silver. They're speculating like crazy. I mean, big volume. You know, these people are swinging millions around in personal assets in just trading silver. You know, it's incredible. It's you know, it's actually one of the most volatile commodities out there at the moment. And of course, the intraday moves are huge, but it attracts, you know, everybody. It's a bit like going into a casino. The hot table is always where everybody wants to be. Nobody wants to look at a boring table, you know, a cold table.
Well, I think it's the same. Let's say public consciousness of silver is certainly growing. I was at a restaurant last night and just happened to look up at the TV, and they had, you know, a map of the world basically showing China and India, or highlighting China and India, and saying, is $150 silver coming next? And this was just a random sports broadcast. I think there was some car racing or something on that TV. So I definitely think that it is growing, and that is, you know, the typical behavior of silver. As more people get into it, more people get interested in it.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's fun while it lasts. It won't last, you know, always like this, because the volatility will eventually quieten down. But at the moment it's there, and it's really likely to stay for at least the foreseeable future.
Peter, what kind of targets do you have for silver at this moment? Like you showed us this gold chart that shows us some of the volatility that you were expecting. What are
I've got silver here, I think.
Downside targets for silver.
This was silver from the 5th of February. We expected a downswing to about 64 and three quarters, and then a big swing up to 97, something like that. And if you take a look at what I did last night, I'll pull this across, you'll see that this movement down to 64 something, and then a swing up to 90, let's call it 98. And this is what it did. It swung down to 64, so that was almost perfect.
Yeah.
And it's gone up to 90, it's almost hit 97, 98. It's got to 96.40 over there. I mean, that's incredible. But that's how precise Elliott Wave can be. And now got gold and silver are breathing down. Silver is actually going to head down to here.
58, 20, 59, 60, somewhere in there.
Something like that. Something just below $60, you know, it's easy to remember. Something like that before we I mean, we'll check the ratio and proportions. It could go a tiny bit lower, but I don't think probably will go a lot lower. I think that will be probably enough. But you know, we've already been down to 78 bucks today from 96 2 days ago.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, this is, you know, a huge movement. So when you look at it like that, but that's where I think we pick up silver again. You know, I know a lot of people that are long physical. We have clients who are long physical, and we're basically doing these updates, these relatively short-term swings and updates almost on a daily basis for them so that they can engineer hedging. So they hedge their physical longs, you know, and so they're basically selling on these upside rallies that we pinpoint and then lifting them off when we hit a low again.
Yeah, it's not that they're, as you said, they're only hedging their physical positions. They're not selling and trying to trade in and out of their physical position.
Yeah, I mean, we have some hedge funds who are selling outright. You know, they're not even owning anything. But so there's a mix of different two groups going on here that we see across the trading desk. But otherwise, no. I mean, and it's our job really to just isolate where these turning points come in. So far, I have to say, it's been pinpoint accurate, you know, really. And it's amazing to see that. And as I say, you know, it's very humbling when you see that, because how can you possibly pick up on these turning points without, you know, without recognizing that there's a mathematical equation involved in financial markets, even with all of the financial situation in the Middle East going on, and you can still basically make an assumption based on some credible mathematic formula here that, you know, prices will move up and eventually, you know, they won't go up after an outbreak of war like this, but they will actually go down. I mean, that's a pretty big call. And it's actually happening. So you've got to ask yourself, well, what's the mathematical algorithm behind that? Why does Elliott Wave give us a very fortitudinal idea of prediction, you know, because, you know, that means that there's a deterministic model involved, and that has a, you know, a much bigger, wider spread philosophical idea of about why these things should work, but they do. And when they are this accurate, you have a pretty good idea of what the landscape looks like ahead, which is of course part of our financial you know, purpose to be able to see what's coming down the road.
Peter, one of the other markets that you've recently analyzed is platinum. What is the risk of the downswing in platinum right now, considering that it has reached its new highs ahead of schedule?
Yeah, I mean, that one really did accelerate and take off. We knew that platinum would outperform even silver when we updated the gold-silver ratio in our annual report. But I have to confess that even though we'd been talking about platinum outperforming silver, it did it in really very, very quick succession. And I think that we're probably going to have to eventually raise our upside targets even higher than what we had before. I mean, we talked about new record highs, but we're going to have to talk about much, much broader sort of movements up for platinum at some point. I'm just moving all across to see where I've got platinum charts. Let's have a look. Yeah,
I kind of surprised you with that one. Sorry, Peter.
Yeah, no, I've got some charts we can look at. I mean, actually, this was some of the reports that we had going into platinum. And we talked about record highs, you know, going up to here. And you can see it's gone exponentially higher, and really in very, very quick succession. So I think we're probably going to have to raise those targets, because the pattern sequence normally would develop into seven price swings from 558. That's, you know, going back to the pandemic low. Mm-hmm. We had three up to 1339, and we've got a straightforward advance in the fourth sequence, and we need or the fifth, and we need a sixth and seventh going up. So I think we'll raise our targets ultimately to where it's been. We're in a current correction down at the moment. I'm actually just getting to platinum at the moment to update it. We've got some downside targets which align to the correction downside targets for gold at 4,000, 4018 that we saw just now. But I haven't quite finished that yet. But platinum will pull lower in conjunction with gold and silver down at the moment in the short term. And then we probably have another big swing up. And this one, just looking at the measurements here visually, without using my tools, I can imagine that we'll probably end up at something like 4,500, 4,600 in the future. So something like that's going on. Because once this correction's finished, once gold gets down to 4,000 and silver gets down to 5,860, we're talking about new highs then. So that will be congruent to a simultaneous higher high for platinum as well.
Do you see that, you know, that movement, or let's say that movement back up starting, you know, what is your time frame on that, Peter? For gold and silver?
Well, gold and silver are moving very rapidly, as you can see. So if we, you know, we might be getting down to 4,000 on gold by the end of the month, early April. So you know, that's the sort of, you know, the sort of March, April timeline. This will take longer than it took for the initial downswing from January's high into that early February low. So it's gonna probably be, you know, quite a bit longer than that. I think we'll need at least until the end of March, maybe into mid February, to get down to 4,000 ultimately. But once that happens, then you know, we're gonna start seeing. Don't forget that once we get down to 4,000 or thereabouts, you know, sentiment's going to be bearish, right?
Right.
Sentiments, we're to actually acknowledge where we want to be buying that, we should be seeing sentiment turn from bullish to bearish, basically. So we need to check where sentiment is. We need to check, you know, what the open interests are like. That should have shrunk quite a bit because, in recent surveys, particularly from, I think, those that are published online from Bank of America, the latest February sentiments show that gold is still out there as one of the most crowded long positioning trades. You know, it's even longer than Mag 7. So that needs to be all unwound. And once the markets are becoming bearish, the sentiment starts to swing around and the pendulum swings completely opposite. When we get down to sub, you know, $60 on silver and something heading towards 4,000 on gold, we'll take another look, check the pattern sequence. If the ratios are correct and the sentiment is bearish, you know, that will give us our next signal. But I think it's going to be, it might be sooner, but I would maybe stretch out. The maximum I would expect is probably mid-April. I think nothing more than that. I think by that time, that will be ample time to complete these corrections down.
Peter, one of the other markets that I was wondering if we could go over would be uranium. You know, this is part of an important part of the commodity complex. Obviously, something that gets affected and or thrown back into consciousness, let's say around wars, especially. What is your kind of roadmap for uranium right now?
But this is a sort of an inflation pop cycle upswing from 2016's low when it was around $18. And this has moved up since to about 103. This is spot uranium. And we're currently engaged in a correction downswing before we go up again to 200 plus. That correction, I checked the price today earlier and it was about 86 and a half, the spot uranium price. But we had a target in January in this report going up to about 87.28, so it's still trying to stretch up a little bit. But it's in a corrective phase from the 2016 low at 18, and that correction should bring us down later this year, early next, to about minimum 52-something and maybe maximum 46. But, you know, that... it's an interesting cycle one, because obviously uranium is also coming up into the conversation about data centers, because right. President Trump has recently said, hey, you guys who are building these data centers, you know, these hyperscalers, You need to provide your own source of power to fuel the data centers. You know, don't rely on the grid. Maybe, just maybe, don't know how, whether it's possible or whether there would be, you know, the International Energy Agency would have an objection, but maybe collectively these guys might start tapping into nuclear power at some point. The thing is that interesting is that to mine uranium, it's quite in the 60s and 70s, USA had quite a bit of uranium mining, and then it basically got defuncted, closed down, and it's starting to revive again. But the refining of uranium, ironically, comes from Russia. And so you export your ore, and then they bring it back into refined uranium. And so even the US uses refined uranium from Russia. It's not come under the radar too much in that discussion, but it would be interesting to see whether that manipulates the price action in any format. But at the moment, this is really patterning out very nicely in terms of Elliott process, the methodology behind Elliott, with five price wings dictating direction of main trend and three waves as the counter trend. Seems to be working pretty well when we examine the five waves up from 18 to this 106 high, which was traded back in January 24. And since January 24, spot prices have been lower. There's been a lot of speculation on the ETFs, which have gone into new record highs, but you know, there is a dislocation between that and even in the oil prices. I mean, a lot of oil ETFs are trading at record highs, even though oil prices, underlying oil prices, are down 50% from the March 22 highs.
Right.
And they say that that's because of, you know, corporates streamlining their efficiencies and things like that, which is why they're, you know, and they're getting cheaper financing and whatnot. That's why the prices are up. But at some stage, you know, that dislocation will also have to revert back to a standard deviation norm. And that might be the case with the uranium ETS versus where the spot price is. You know, that would be an interesting look at where that deviation reverts back to a standard deviation norm.
Well, Peter, I really appreciate you walking us through all of these different markets, all of your targets, and how you come about figuring them out. Is there anything that you'd like to leave listeners to think about or to consider before we wrap up here today?
Well, only on the fact that, you know, it's quite topical to start thinking about what's going on in the Middle East. You know, one of the things which I would say is that, and I always tell our team of analysts here, is that question everything in life, but particularly against financial markets, what you're reading, you have to be very discriminative these days. Just like, you know, when we read, you know, over the weekend about pundits talking about, you know, $100 on Monday morning for crude oil. Do your research. Try and align to some rational thinking. Try and find a methodology that works for you. And question everything. That way you stay on the right side of things, because it's easy to get mistracked and misled. As I say, be very discriminative. And try and do a bit of your own research as well. Question everything. And that way you should find the answers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good piece of advice, especially considering that there's never been more access to, you know, quote unquote news. And I feel like much of it is just noise, and being able to decipher between what is valuable and what is noise is in some ways becoming easier. But if you haven't built that skill over the last little while, it is very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, we always used to talk about an individual, if you're trading the markets, you know, try and grasp and build up your repertoire of different aspects which give you some surety about what you're dealing with and making decisions. I mean, look, none of us are perfect, and we will make mistakes, but we've got to basically realize that, you know, the mistakes are going to be few and far between. That most of our decision making comes from experiential exposure to key events and how they behave, and being able to determine and make differentiation between fact and fiction. It's your job really to try and find tools and elements to that. Obviously, we provide a consultancy service, and we're producing reports each month and each week, to short-term bi-weekly reports that we send out. If you'll excuse the PR bit, you know, if you just go to wavetrack.com, you'll find details of our reports there. But every time that you do so, you know, even with ours, you know, analysis, even though we do very, very thorough cross-referencing of different asset classes, what ratios are doing amongst them to try and give us insights to what things are doing. You know, that thoroughness has to be done in order to enhance your and heighten the probability of success when you're trading and financing. But you know, just build up your own repertoire of different tools and sets, and stick to them. You know, don't overcomplicate as well, because if you do that, you'll lose sight of where you are. There's a certain amount of feel as well, intuitive feel. You'll know eventually whether, you know, something feels right when you're looking at it or not. That's part of the process of differentiation and determination. So that's always an important prospect and process that you can enhance yourself as well. Yeah.
And of course, in addition to the website, you guys have an X page at @ElliottWave_WTI.
Yeah, that's our X, formerly Twitter, right? And you know, you can actually log into that. If you go into our mainstream website at wavetrack.com, you will find subscription services here. And when you log in to our Elliott Wave Compass report, you'll come into this one. And the great thing about this is that, you know, we're producing reports twice a week. So we're looking at stock indices, some equities, currencies, fixed income, and commodities here, particularly with gold and silver. And some of the charts that I showed you short term today are basically derived from this report. So you can get online access, and you can download the PDF that accompanies it as well. So that's, you know, really useful for anybody that wants to be kept in touch with some of these key indices and commodities and currencies as well.
Absolutely. Excellent, Peter. Well, I really appreciate it again, and look forward to the next time.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Tom. I really appreciate it, and good luck with everything.
Thank you, sir.